into something else, is the din of women's head covering. You do a little of men's and women's head covering. The topic of kisei rosh for women. The Shulchan Aruch says, lo telachna benos yisrael perus rosh vashuk, that a woman should not be in the public with her hair uncovered. And that's based on a Gemara in Ksuvas. The Gemara in Ksuvas, and Daf Ayin Beis Min Aleph 72a, the Gemara says, the Gemara there is describing when a couple is, God forbid, not functioning well, and the couple ends up parting. So we know that we have a rule, we have an approach within the Torah, which is nowadays enacted in a different way than the original, and that is that there's a ksuva. If, God forbid, a family unravels, God forbid, a husband passes away, or if a couple decides to get divorced, so the rabbi is put into place, and it's based on an idea in the Torah that the woman should have some kind of compensation. So that compensation is called the ksuva. Compensation meaning she should have some kind of support. So that support is called the ksuva. That's the basic support. Under every chuppah, after the husband gives the ring to his wife, we read the ksuva, and that ksuva was signed usually right before the chuppah. And that ksuva is a document, and in that document we record the alimony settlement, which we hope we'll never have to deal with. But inside every ksuva, the Ashkenazi ksuva, has a certain amount to set aside if the couple would unravel, that the wife gets. That's called the basic suva. Then the husband adds on an amount that we call the additional suva, Tosefes suva. And then the amount that the wife brings into marriage is then summarized and given an amount as well. So the standard Ashkenazi suva is about 270 pounds or 230 pounds, look up again, of silver. Whatever the rate of the silver is. So the Sephardi ksuva is still open. The way it was originally. Originally, every ksuva document was open. And it was discussed. What would the alimony settlement be? The Gemara says that was often the source of argument, even before they got married. The Gemara says, less ksuva, the less batigra. Almost every ksuva was a source of a discussion and discomfort. The Ashkenazi ksuva, somewhere in the last 500 years, became a one-size-fits-all for all people. Nowadays, in the last 50, 60 years, maybe even longer, so the ksuv is not really at all important for us. I shouldn't say that. The amount in the ksuv is not all important, because nowadays with the court system, so a woman will usually do better if she goes to court than if she executes the ksuv. So when a couple gets divorced nowadays, the woman usually waives the ksuva, even in a beis din. The couple waives the ksuva because the beis din has to figure out what is the reasonable way of supporting this woman, as the court would figure out. So the ksuva nowadays, we don't, it's a document, it's a binding document, the concept behind the ksuva is extremely important. That's where the husband commits himself to support his wife, and even more so, commits himself to support his wife, even if he's not in the picture anymore. If he gets divorced, he supports his wife, and if, God forbid, he dies, then he commits the estate to supporting his wife. So that concept is very, very important. In fact, the Gemara says, and this is how we paskin, that if a couple gets married without a ksuva, so even though the marriage is binding, the husband gave the ring to his wife, in front of two Edom, nevertheless, the Gemara says that when they live together, it's as if they're living biznus, as if they're living a life of prostitutes. Why is that? It's the pshat of the following. What is the character of a life of a prostitute? That there's no security in the relationship, that there's no stability in the relationship. So the Gemara is making an extreme statement that if you have that with the way the Torah envisions a husband and wife, is there's a certain degree of security that they have. And if a husband knows, as the Gemara says, that he has to support his wife, and that he will be held responsible to support his wife, even if the marriage unravels, then he will be much more careful in walking out on his wife. So the ksuva has a measure of stability of the marriage and a measure of security for the woman. That if she, Baruch Hashem, has five children, and she has a measure of security that going forward, she will get this support, and the court will give her support, either the Beis Din or the host country court. So all of that gives a person a certain stability. So the Gemara made an extreme statement. It doesn't mean that without a ksuva, they're living biznus. But what Chazal is saying is that if a couple doesn't have a ksuva, so then they're not providing, the husband is not providing the security or the stability which the Torah wants him to provide. All right? And that's why the halacha is that a woman always has to be aware of where the ksuva is. Again, not because without the ksuva she will not get an alimony settlement. She'll get the alimony settlement. But with the piece of paper, she'll have an easier time. She'll go to court, and the court will see she was once married and see that the ksuva has never been executed. The moment she doesn't have a piece of paper, so she's open, she's exposed to all sorts of counterclaims. The husband could say, I prepaid the ksuva. I negotiated the ksuva out already. The mink coat she's wearing, I told her she wants the mink coat, that's her ksuva. So without the piece of paper, she has some exposure. With the piece of paper, so she is in the stronger position. Would anybody ever challenge her right to ksuva? So the Gemara says that therefore a woman always has to be aware that she has the ksuva. And that's why if a couple, again, doesn't have to go overly fanatic about this, but woman has to, if a woman would lose the ksuva, then the couple has to get a new ksuva. If the ksuva gets damaged, the couple has to get a new ksuva. Now, what does this have to do with head covering? Because the Gemara says that there could be situations where the Beis Din will not impose the ksuva rights. That's in the non-Jewish system, it's called whose fault was a divorce. Now there's a new, even in New York, there's going to be no-fault divorce, I think. But in the non-Jewish courts, there is an idea of us trying to establish who was the one who brought about this divorce. So in halacha, you have not a similar idea, but you have similar situations where the Beis Din will say that if a person was at fault for causing the divorce, so then they lose their right to ksuva. So the Gemara gives various examples. So one example of a woman who would lose her right to ksuva is if a woman tripped up her husband. In other words, they got married as a religious couple, and they were committed to being religious, and then, at one point, the woman decides she's not going to be religious anymore. So she would still get her ksuva. But if she would decide she's not going to be religious, and she will not make it easy for her husband to be religious, she'll trip him up. In other words, she'll tell him this food is kosher. And he finds that after it's not kosher. She'll tell him that she took challah from the dough. That she'll tell him that she took trumas and ma'aseres. She'll tell him that she went to mikveh, she didn't go to mikveh. So the husband finds any of these things out, then the husband, as far as Allah is concerned, the husband, if they get divorced, they can't work it out, if counseling doesn't work, if she doesn't do tshuva, and they end up getting divorced, then the halach is that he is freed from having to support her after a divorce. Because you can interpret it in many ways, but she broke the deal. She made it impossible for them to live together. So now one of the examples that the Mishnah gives of a woman who would lose her right to ksuva is Yoitzev Erosha Perua. They got married like an Ephraim couple. Alright, so she covers her hair. It's standard. And then at some point he sees that she is not keeping the mitzvah of Kisei Rosh. So the Gemara says, the Mishnah says that would also be, but Moshe has a Shiloh, what happens if the couple, when they got married, so they weren't so religious, so she didn't cover her hair. And then the husband became more religious. So now, with that, can he force his wife, so to speak, would this halacha apply in that case? So there Moshe said, no, that wouldn't apply, because when you got married, you had a certain deal. She says she has to cover her hair. But not covering her hair in that situation is not seen as that she's tripping him up. He became firmer. Mitzvah Shem should also become firmer. But that's the source of the din. The source of the din is that the Gemara, the Mishnah says that just like if a woman would trip up the husband and not keep kosher, and not make it hard for him to keep kosher, or just like, so too, if a woman would not keep some of the appropriate acts of modesty, so too, that would be considered to be grounds for divorce. Again, what does that mean, grounds for divorce? It means not that the husband will be forced to divorce his wife. No, it means that should they decide to get divorced, then she will have forfeited her right to alimony because she has broken the deal, so to speak. And the Gemara seems to equate a similar idea. A woman, and for that matter, husband as well, if one spouse becomes less vigilant in the areas of modesty, so that is considered to be making undermining the home. Just like if a woman doesn't let her husband keep kosher by feeling that undermines the home, so too, if either a husband or a wife, it goes both ways, would all of a sudden have an inappropriate, start being inappropriately flirtatious, or inappropriately in an egregious way, be in violation of the norms of modesty which they've accepted as a couple, which the community accepts, so that scene is undermining the family. So, and that's the source where the Gemara now begins to discuss this idea. Well, what is the halacha of a woman having to cover her after she gets married? And here it's important to understand that there are two entirely different sugyas and shas that discuss women's head covering. And we have first have to separate men's head covering from women's head covering. Men's head covering is a different parasha altogether. Men's head covering comes under two categories. Both are minhagim. One is that we are yarmulke. That's a minhag. Gemara says that a man should not go dalet ames without his head being covered. So that's it does not seem to be a takana from Chazal. It does not seem to be. It seems to be a minhag Yisrael, a very powerful, overwhelming minhag Yisrael. The men should always cover their hair, right? Cover their heads. And but nevertheless, because it's a minhag, so Rav Moshe writes in one of the early tshuvas, he points out that which is a common practice in America, certainly till the late 60s, and it was a common practice in parts of Europe as well, that men did not wear yarmulkes in business. They did not wear yarmulkes when they went to work. Both in America and early in Europe, I remember that it was very uncommon. I grew up in Toronto, and Canada is a little bit behind America, but very uncommon for men to wear a yarmulke if they were lawyers, if they were doctors, if they were engineers. Very uncommon. And people remember in Europe also that it was not common for men to cover their hair. Why? Because it was seen as an impediment to getting it to Parnassah. So if it would be a din derabbanan and you have to cover it, then we'd have to take the consequences. But since it's a minhag, we assume that the minhag was formulated for situations other than severe impediments. If you couldn't get a job with a yarmulke, so then the minhag would say, well, that the minhag wasn't for this kind of situation. If a person feels, that their patients will look at them differently. And their patients, let's say a person's a psychologist, and the psychologist feels that if patients come in and the psychologist is wearing a yarmulke, the patient will not be as open to what the psychologist has to say. He won't be as effective as he's supposed to be. So there would also be grounds for not wearing a yarmulke. That was the common practice that happened in the 60s and 70s. In the late 60s, there was a major change within America of openness and more acceptance of different cultures within America. And that then developed in America into the concept of multi-ethnicity. And that's what you see nowadays, that ethnic groups, the melting pot in America changed very significantly from being a melting pot to one mainstream to be a melting pot and accepting variety of ethnic values and cultures. So when that happened, so the Jewish people living in America, and the from people felt much more comfortable covering wearing yarmulkes. That was a major change that happened probably in the late 60s, probably around then. That's when it comes to men. Then there's another idea that men have, is that in situations of severe gravity, very serious situations, is another minhag that some people have to cover their hair again, cover their head again. Like during Shmoneh Esrei, with the Zatalis, and during Krishma, with it to the hat. So that comes under the category of a minhag or of minhagim of tefillah, minhagim of Kabbalah's, of showing the gravity situation. That's an entirely different parasha. What we're discussing right now are two sets of halachos, two sugyas. One sugya in brachos that deals with modesty, and one sugya in ksuvas that deals with the mitzvah of a woman covering your head in outside of the little modesty. Good question. Go ahead, Jeffrey.
What does the amos have to do with the minhag? Is that part of the minhag, or is that just like something that's like
drush? I don't know. So that's a question. A good question. I don't know if there is a clear cut answer in that. In other words, there are those who interpret it to be specific. Dalan amos is four amos. And the concept is that four amos defines the space around a person. Right? On Shabbos, if a person is in a place where there's no Erev, so you cannot carry something for four amos. That's considered to be one space. One's personal private space. That's the concept you have in America also. Like, speak about the idea of a person invading your space. So the Torah says everybody has a dalad amos space around them. So that's their own personal rishos. So I shouldn't go out of my own personal, I shouldn't move significantly, right? And others say that that was just a way of describing that one should always try to have a yarmulke, wasn't given any specific. So that's why you'll find sometimes that people are very, very careful not to walk for amos without a yarmulke. And others will say, no, that's not what it meant. In fact, there's even, you have a similar discussion when it comes to, in the morning, washing one's hands. You shouldn't go Dalad Amos without washing one's hands in the morning. So there are Jews who take it, letter of the law, very seriously, and they have bowls of water next to their bed. And they're saying, that's not what it didn't mean you can't take you can't walk for 6 feet. It meant one shouldn't go to the house, one shouldn't do something significant, one shouldn't get involved in something before washing one's hands. So this is a similar idea. You find different, and because they're minhagim, that means that different groups of Jews interpret it different ways. When it comes to a woman covering her head, then it's a different issue altogether. And there, the Torah, there's again two separate sugyas. It's very important to keep this in mind, that they're two separate sugyas, because this is the issue which is much discussed as to whether the two sugyas are related or not. All right, so the sugya in Ksuvas. The sugya in Ksuvas, the one that we discussed, that we began with, about the rights of alimony. So there the Gemara says that, the Gemara points out, again in Ksuvas, Ayin, Beis, and Aleph, is the Gemara says, Roisha Perua Deiraisi, that if a woman walks with her hair uncovered, that's considered to be a violation of a Din Deiraisa, of something from the Torah. How do we know this? Because when it comes to the Isha Sota, what's the Isha Sota? That's a woman who did something inappropriate. She spent time privately with another guy. She had violated the Isha Vichu with another guy. So the question, the woman who was Sota did something inappropriate. She secluded herself with another guy. And the husband says to his wife, I don't like this. Lokenios, I don't want you to be alone with this guy. And he discussed it with her, and they said, ate him. And then, Afal Pikein, she spent time with this guy again. And he believes that they had the beer together, they had relations together. Yeah. So in that case, he's now, if in fact she did have relations with this guy, so then she is prohibited to marry this guy that she had relations with. She's an HD, she's a married woman. And she's no longer allowed to live with her husband. That's the halacha. Person, an HD, a woman who commits it was part of an adulterous relationship, so she's asur leboila ulabala. She cannot live with her husband and cannot live with the adulterer. So he believes, the husband believes, that their marriage is doomed because he thought that she's living with another guy. Now, therefore he takes her to Beis HaMikdash. The Gemara says, the Torah says, it's the Parsha of Sota. The woman did something that was wrong. The husband thinks that she's doing this terribly wrong. So now, the only way to settle this situation is that the Rabban Shum said that you'll bring your wife to the Beis HaMikdash and you discuss with the Kohen. The Kohen will grill the husband and wife and see, in fact, whether it meets the test of the Parsha Sota. And then, as you know, if she stands in her story that they did not have relations, and he stands in his accusations, so then the only way out of the situation, the Kodesh Baruch Hu says, you take the Parsha Sota, and which includes the Kodesh Baruch Hu's name, you read the Parsha Sota, and you erase Kodesh Baruch Hu's name in water, take Kodesh Baruch Hu, never erase Kodesh Baruch Hu's name, but this is the one time Kodesh Baruch Hu said, I'm willing to erase my name, in order that in order to be able to test the situation, and hopefully be able to bring this family together. Right? The Musar Haskel, the ideas in this are tremendous. First of all, the Kodesh Baruch Hu was saying is very often family strife is because members of the family stand in their conviction. They stand in their egos. So Kodesh Baruch Hu says, I want to show you something. I want to show you how important it is to swallow one's ego, especially if it means to keep the family together. I'm going to take my name. You know, Kodesh Baruch Hu said, okay. Yeah. Can't erase the Kodesh Baruch Hu's name. You can't scratch the Kodesh Baruch Hu's name. You say, it's going to be erased. Because that's what I'm going to teach you. In order for a family together, get over the ego. And then, Kodesh Baruch Hu says, in order to bring Shalom, because hopefully what happened over here is the husband overreacted. Hopefully. Hopefully she did not live with somebody. She did something wrong. She had Isur V'yichud. She violated the din, otherwise she wouldn't be there. She's not a tzedekah, she made a mistake. But it wasn't of the order that he thinks she did. So in that case, Kodesh Baruch Hu says, let's see if we can bring the family back together. And that is that hopefully the woman will drink the water and she will remain whole, nothing will happen. Oh, and then we'll see that he's an honest man, she's an honest woman, and they made a terrible mistake, and a terrible misjudgment. She made a mistake of having yichud, and he made a mistake of accusing her. If on the other hand they didn't make mistakes, another man, let's say she is has been an adulteress, then she will waste away. What happens if he was an adulterer as well? He was having his own kolapoisel v'mumipoisel. That he, the reason why he knows she was having an adulterous relationship because he's been fooling around as well, then he'll also waste away. On the other hand, if he made an honest mistake trying to keep the family together. He was honestly concerned that his wife was having a fling, and she was not. So then the family will move forward, and they'll be blessed, and they'll even have children afterward, more children. So again, I often use this as an example. Sometimes a couple will come, and they are they're good people, but and hopefully they're a good match, but they're having difficult times. And they're really very, very angry at each other and very hurt and offended by each other. And they maybe have done bad things to each other. So obviously I'm not equipped, but I would push them very strongly to go for counseling. So very often a couple will say, do you think that we can give you a shock? Look at how we've hurt each other. Look at how bruised we are, how upset we are. So I said, that's the parsha of Sota. If there's any couple that you thought can never make it back together again, there's a couple where the husband accused his wife of being an adulteress. That's, I don't know if it gets worse. Right? She did something wrong by having some kind of relationship with a guy. She just didn't go over one red line. She went over a different red line. And he's accusing her of being of infidelity. And the Gemara says, the Torah says, that couple can make it. They can get past this. So if a couple can get past that, that means a couple, they really try, and they're a good match, and they try to refresh the chemistry and the reasons for them to stay together, that they can probably make it. So in the course of this whole parsha, which sounds like it's unrelated, in the course of this whole parsha, the Torah says, we want to make sure that the woman really stands by her story. So we try to confuse the woman. So how do we try to confuse her? How do we get her to shake her up? So one of the ways that they do it is they take her from place to place in the base of Mikdash. One way that they do it is that they uncover her. For us, Roy Shaisha. They uncover her as the Gemara said, the Torah is going to come here. Is there a halacha that she has to wear? How could the Torah write? For us, Roy Shaisha. Could the Torah say, and the Kohen takes off her red shirt? She's not wearing a red shirt. Could the Kohen say, and we take off her skirt? Maybe she's wearing a dress. Maybe she's wearing a jumper. So the Torah says, and you uncover hair, that means that the Torah is telling us by innuendo that every woman has her hair covered. Otherwise, the Torah could say, Poros Resha Isha. So the Gemara says, we learn from here, is the halacha that a woman has to have her hair covered. Now the question is, well, how much, what, where, when? So here's where the Gemara explains to us that the mitzvah day raisa of a woman covering her hair is in public. That's a mitzvah day raisa. How much is it to cover in public? The Gemara tells us it has to be a kalos. We're not sure what that means. The Gemara says in the time of the Gemara, so very often women would carry things on their heads. How would they carry them? By having inverted baskets. They would have a basket that would go in their head. I have no idea how big it was. And it'd be big enough to support a basket on top of it. So this was the basket cap, which would then be in this part of it. I'm not sure exactly where. But it had to be someplace. And then under that, on top of that, she'd be able to put... carry a basket of fruit or a basket of wheat or something. So the Gemara says, Kalosa, the basket that's on top of her cap, that's the requirement in Deiraisa. In Deiraisa, as far as the Torah is concerned, she has to have a cap that's on her head and that's obligated, she's obligated to wear that in the public area. What about in the privacy of her own home? So the Gemara says that this particular din of Kisei Rosh, here we're going to be very careful because there are several different aspects of a woman covering her hair. This particular aspect of the mitzvah d'oraisa of a woman covering her hair, that is only in the public area. What about if it's a semi-public area, semi-private area? It's not a privacy of your own home. It's not the public street, but it's the lobby of the apartment, semi-public, semi-private. What happens if it's the cul-de-sac, the end of the cul-de-sac? So at the end of a no-outlet street, so it's not a huge thoroughfare, but there are people that are there. So the Gemara says that's a mitzvah d'rabbanan. Then in that case, you should also cover her hair. Since we have a d'oraisa, the cover hair in the public area, and a d'rabbanan, the cover hair in a semi-public, semi-private area. Then there is another Gemara altogether, and that's the Gemara in Brachos. The Gemara in Brachos says a thing in Chav Beis and Beis. Sorry, 24a. There the Gemara says that another din altogether, that there are that a woman cannot dress or undress in a seductive fashion. She can't do something that is seductive or alluring. So, for example, if a woman would wear a short skirt, so therefore her legs would be showing, that's considered to be alluring and seductive, right? In general, halacha number one is a woman cannot dress in an alluring or seductive fashion, and that would be determined the way society determines it. You'll be kafi amokam or kafi asman. Could be that a person. For example, if a person is living in Manhattan, in the middle of Manhattan, and it's a summer day, and it's a hot summer day, so what would be considered to be attractive, literally attractive or alluring, that would try to catch somebody's attention, would be different than if they're in a winter day in the northern part of Canada. And in Achram, and halacha would be defined that way. Or would be different than a person in the core of Bnei Brak, in the core of Geula, of Bnei Ashar. So therefore, if a woman, for example, would wear a skirt that maybe even goes below the knee, but the bottom of her leg is showing, it could be that in Bnei Brak, that's considered to be a violation of the din. That could be considered to be an eye-catching, an alluring, a seductive act. And if a woman could be dressed the exact same way in Manhattan in a summer day, and be 100% perfect, it would not be a violation of anything. And so that's one halacha, that a woman cannot be dressed in an alluring or seductive fashion. All right, and that would be defined in a way that would stop people and try to catch people. But then the Gemara goes on to say that kol b'isha erba, if a woman is singing, so that can be alluring or seductive. Say her b'isha erba, a woman has her hair uncovered and her hair is flowing, and it's blowing in the wind, that can be a seductive or alluring or an eye-catching way to dress. A woman wears shok b'isha erba, if she wears skirts that are above the knee, so that the thigh area down to the knee is showing, that's considered to be an alluring or seductive thing to do. Right? And the Gemara quotes Psukim from Shir HaShirim to show that in terms of men, so we have to be careful not to look at any woman except for our wives in a way that's just to get pleasure or no from that. These are difficult halachas to keep in the 21st century. They were difficult in the 20th century as well. And often, always hard halachas to keep. There's always a halacha that is difficult and to some extent, I wouldn't say unnatural, because that's the wrong use of the term, but it's certainly, men have always had a yetzer hara, have always had an interest and excitement and a passion and a fantasy. So halacha always asks of us to do something that is very, very difficult and something which you have to be very careful of. And as society becomes more and more decadent, it becomes more and more difficult for us to keep these halachas. It's a different challenges at different times. Our time, we don't have the challenge of Shmir Shabbos. Right? It wasn't so long ago that Jews had a hard time keeping Shabbos. They would lose their jobs if they kept Shabbos. So that we don't have that challenge right now. On the other hand, in the 1950s, people didn't have to close their eyes when a bus drove by. And we have to be careful about how we're looking at buses. So every generation is different, the challenges. So that's one of the great challenges of our time. So the Gemara defined these three ideas as, number one, that it is prohibited for a man to look at a woman in order to get pleasure or enjoyment, and specifically to look at the sayer, the open hair of a woman, and to look at the thigh of a woman, and to listen to a woman's singing voice. All right, that's the now. As a result of now there's a discussion amongst the poskim of the 20th century how to interpret this Gemara, and it's usually referred to as a machlokes between the Aruch HaShulchan. Aruch HaShulchan was the Bechil Mechel, the Rav Abin Nevardek, the Bechil Mechel Epstein, and the Mishneh Berurah, the Chavetz Chaim. Right, the machlokes probably goes back earlier, but this is the way it's usually referred to in terms of the contemporary svar. Glenn?
But the flowing hair applies to Marianne.
So that's a very good, that's a sticky point in this whole discussion.
Then the Muslims have a right. It's just from the basement end. Everyone has their hair covered. Everyone after a certain age is covered.
Right. So let's hold on that for a moment, because as you know, the common practice is that the din of a woman covering her hair, we only apply after a woman gets married. In Hasidic circles, they have that before a woman gets married, she braids her hair. She keeps it tight, so to speak. So that, we'll come back to that point this time, next time, and iron out that point. There is, I want to organize the basic sources first, and then we'll discuss some of the confusing points in each piece. So what we've said so far is that there really are two separate parshios, and that's what's crucial to understand. One parsha is a parsha that's learned from Sot, the Poskim Chumash, and when it's to cover hair. And another parsha is the parsha of tznius, of modesty, of erva, of not to be not the cave in to the decadence of the group that's around. Now, here's the crucial debate, which shapes the common practice. The Aruch HaShulchan's understanding was that the issue of erva is entirely defined by place and time. And therefore, the Aruch HaShulchan argued that if once society becomes such, Western society, that women's hair is always uncovered, so then it stops being a source of fantasy, a source of great pleasure, stops being seductive. Right? The Chashulchan said there really is no different in these three items which the Gemara identified. That when it comes to erva, when it comes to the prohibitions of how a woman can dress and expose herself, it will always be based on what's going on in the society around her. If society has hit new levels of decadence, then people become immune to it. If you have a whole society where people's hair is uncovered, so people become immune to it, just like we would argue a doctor. Right? A doctor examines women the way that a non-Jewish doctor examines women. So what's the basis for the heter? That at some point the doctor's training, they begin to focus on the woman only in terms of the medical presentation. They don't focus on the woman as a woman. And since they become immune because of being overexposure, so therefore we say that at some point, how do we know that that's correct? The Gemara says that one of the Amayram, I think it was Rav Chisda, the Gemara says that Rav Chisda used to dance with a kala on his shoulders. So the Gemara says, how can he do that? It sounds like a violation of the laws of Moses. He said that when she's, I know that it's misamecher, right? So I'm fulfilling the mitzvah of being misamech, chasam and kala. And when she's on my shoulder, it's just like having white planks, or white ducks, kuki chimiyana, the Gemara says. He says, it doesn't occur to me that she is, he was on a certain level, Madrega, where he was able to maintain his own mind, then it's not a woman on his shoulders. Now, what's the point? You see from this vignette that if a person comes to the point where they're able to distance themselves from the reality of the situation of the person, so then if they're able to become immune and they become blasé, so then they're allowed to take. They're allowed to function that way. That's why we say the doctor. Once a doctor, if he wants to go into a field where he's going to be examining women, so obviously he is careful the way he does that. But the reason why it's permissible is because at some point in the training, he flips. He morphs from. Go ahead.
Well, what about the first half of the training?
That's a good question. I'm not sure the answer to that question. I don't know the answer to that question. At some point, I don't know how the training works. It could be that after 2 years of book study, so and it's already, the mind already is conditioned that way. I'm not sure. But I believe that it happens at some point like that. Our person has to make it happen. A person has to train themselves to think that way. Go ahead.
Is this status of like becoming acquainted with the show, is that patients were like making brachos and stuff like that in front of that person?
Yeah, very much. So that is the another piece of this discussion is Kriya Shema and brachos and learning. Okay? So part of what you said is correct, but not entirely what you said. In other words, there is another rule over here. And that is one, so we have to divide up all the different parshios. One parsha is the parsha of a woman covering her hair, learned from the parsha of Sota. One parsha is the rules of a woman's dress in order that she will not bring about inappropriate reactions from men. The third part is that whenever men daven or learn to say brachos, it has to be done in a situation where we will be able to focus on the brachos, learning and davening. And if we're in a situation where we won't be able to focus, so then that becomes belittling of the act of davening or learning. So that's why whenever a man davens or learns, he has to be in a situation, says a bracha, where there isn't a woman who's inappropriately dressed. Because that would take away, that's as if saying, I can, it's one thing to say I can multitask, which is also not good. We're not supposed to multitask when we daven or learn. Right? Sometimes that's not lawful. We're not supposed to be carrying anything when we daven. We're supposed to be uniquely focused on davening and learning. So that's a very tall order to get used to, that I can't have anything going on in my mind. That's very, very tough. But the halacha is I have to create a situation where I will not be setting myself up for a major distraction, because that's belittling to the issue at hand. So just like if I had a major, major test coming up, so I would not decide to study in the situation where there are women who are poorly dressed, because I'm not going to be able to study there. So when I daven or learn, so I can't be in a situation where women are inappropriately dressed. Right? So that is part of that. Now, if a person is in a situation, this comes back now to the Aruch HaShulchan of Mishneh Berurah. Right? The Aruch HaShulchan said, as we were developing the idea, that when it comes to Erva, it is always based on place and time. That's the determining factor. And the Mishneh Berurah says that's true at everything except for hair, voice, and the body with a thigh, the body of a woman. Right? The Mishneh Berurah says, the Chafetz Chaim says, why did the Gemara pick out Seyor, Kol, and Shok? Why did the Gemara pick out these three items? Because the Gemara was saying, and why did the Gemara say, we know this from a Pasuk in Shir HaShirim? You know it from the way human beings act. So the Chafetz Chaim said, and again, this is just formulated by the Aruch Hashulchan and the Chafetz Chaim, that's because what the Gemara was pointing out is when it comes to the outer extremities, below the elbow, below the knee, somewhere in the neck area, so then that will be determined by place and time. But when it comes to the inner, the parts of a woman's body, the central parts, the shok and up, and when it comes to the voice and hair, that the Torah said these will always be, these are eternally alluring and eternally seductive. If it so happens that you live in a society where you're saying, I don't get it, I don't see anything seductive or alluring of a woman's hair, I don't see anything seductive about a woman's knee, right? So then what has happened, according to this interpretation, is that we are allowing ourselves to live with a higher level of excitation than the Torah wants us to live. We've gotten used to a higher level of the decadence that the Torah wants us to be used to. So these are two approaches. And these two approaches have significant impact. How is that? When it comes to a woman covering her hair, so everybody agrees, or HaShulchan Mishnah, the woman has to cover her hair. There's hardly any debate. I say hardly, you'll see in a moment. There is, there really is no debate about whether the woman has to cover her hair or not. Right? That's in the public area, and that's with some substantial covering. All right? Does the woman have to cover all of her hair? She has long hair. Does she have to cover all the hair that's flowing out in the back? More than a kalasa? Does the woman have to cover hair when there are other men around in the privacy of her own home? Does she have to cover hair when there are other men around and it's in a semi-private area and she has some basic covering? So that would be in 2011, in 2010, that's going to be a machlokes between the Aruch HaShulchan and the Mishneh Berurah. The Aruch HaShulchan would say, no. The advice that she has to do, she has to cover her hair, that's another parsha of Sota. Beyond that, once she has her hair covered, and she has long flowing hair coming in the back and the front, so nowadays in 2010, no one gets excited about that. That doesn't impact on anybody unless you're living in a place where everybody covers their hair. But if you're living in the New York City, so if you have, the Chacham would say that if a woman is hosting people in her own home, so she can be hosting several couples, but she's not obligated to cover hair in the privacy of her own home, and she is not doing something which is alluring or seductive or inappropriate, because all the guys that are there see this all the time. They work in Wall Street, right? They work in buildings with 10 to 1,000 employees. Most, half of them are women. They all cover their hair. And Mishnah Berurah would say, no. Mishnah Berurah would say, not true. Chafetz Chaim says that when it comes to the thigh of a woman, and when it comes to the upper part above the elbow, when it comes to the woman's singing voice, when it comes to the hair, so there Chazal explained to us that that will always be a violation of a woman's modesty. It will always be something that a husband, that men find attractive and alluring. And therefore the Chafetz Chaim would say that she has to cover hair in the public area because of the din learned from Sota. And she has to also cover hair because it's something that's attractive and alluring and exciting for people. You'll tell me that the men say they don't understand it. So the Chafetz Chaim would say, either he would say, that's the way the Torah established it. We see from Shir HaShirim, Hashmi'idi is kolech, yikolech harev, that the voice is always something that's alluring and attractive. Or he would say, that means that we have already overstepped the bound by getting used to something we shouldn't have gotten used to. And then we do find it alluring, but we're just used to and comfortable living with a higher level of decadence than we should. So that is across the board. Now, there is some confusion that we do have maybe one text, maybe two texts in the history of halacha that have advocated a position that was accepted by certain communities in Europe before the war. And that was that the two suyas are in fact connected. That the reason that it was to cover hair in the public area is because the hair is seen to be alluring and seductive. It didn't separate the two suyas. Right? So there is a sefer, you probably haven't heard of, called the Sefer Yehoshua. He was in probably the 1700s. Yeah. And then there was another author, another Talmud Chacham, probably a great Talmud Chacham, who wrote in America, in New Haven. He wrote a sefer, and they argue this point that the two sugyas are in fact connected. Of course, that has a very important ramification. If you hold the two are connected, then you would be arguing, if you take the Aruch HaShulchan's approach, then you would end up arguing, saying, well, in a society where everybody uncovers their hair, so it's no longer alluring or seductive, and then they would take the next huge jump and say, and therefore, a woman should not have to cover her hair. Right? The way I presented it, and this is not the mainstream. Mainstream means that there's a significant minority of you. The way I presented it, it's not the mainstream. You're talking about the overwhelming approach of anything in print was to separate the sugyas, and therefore, even if one takes liberties of the Aruch HaShulchan, which in itself is a big question, that the Aruch HaShulchan himself writes, but don't think that you don't have to cover your hair. He says, that's a total mistake. He says, it means that when you're making a bracha, you're in a restaurant, and you want a bench. So the Chafetz Chaim would say, if you want a bench, and the woman in the next table has hair on the cover, the Chafetz Chaim says, you have to turn your head. And the Aruch HaShulchan would say, doesn't think so. If you're used to seeing a woman's hair, so you can bench. But the Aruch HaShulchan says, don't think that that means that she doesn't cover her hair. Aruch HaShulchan would say in shul, the mechitza doesn't have to be as high as the tallest woman in the shul, but she still has to cover her hair. So there is. There were communities in Europe, pre-war Europe, that made this connection. Well, maybe she needn't have to cover hair because it's no longer alluring or seductive. So that is again, it's a the war groups accepted it, but it is overwhelmingly indicated that that is an incorrect approach. Albeit there, and by virtue of the fact that you only find it in print in, you know, two places in the literature, it's an incorrect approach. Okay, question. Good. So you want, we can continue next time and discuss a few minutes. What's the next thing that we need?
The review session is on Wednesday and the exam is on Monday, so I think the next...
Okay, so yeah, I apologize. I haven't gotten Monday into my schedule yet. So I'm sorry for being late, and I appreciate that you stay. Okay. Thank you very much. That's right. Don't let it.